Hello and welcome to our Sinton's Neurotrauma podcast series, where over the coming weeks we'll be talking to different people who are involved in the rehabilitation process and the multidisciplinary teams that we set up. My name's David Pritchard and I'm the head of marketing here at Sinton's. Now, we have recorded 5 of these podcasts in total, each lasting approximately 30 to 40 minutes, and we'll be bringing them to you over the coming weeks and months. Our speakers from Sinton's, partner and head of personal injury Mark Quigley, along with partner and neurotrauma lawyer Kate Oliver. Our special guest speaker today is Laura Wilson, who is a clinical neuropsychologist. So without any further ado, straight over to Mark. Mark, good morning and over to you.
Laura, morning. Lovely to see you. Thank you so much indeed for joining us today. This is the second in our series of podcasts where we talk to different people who are involved in multidisciplinary team meetings, working alongside the legal team and our clients who've sustained a quiet brain injury through trauma. So it's great to have you here and very much looking forward to our conversation and finding out more about you and about the role that you undertake as a neuropsychologist within the MDT. So if we can just begin at the beginning and just ask you to tell us a little bit more about you. What's your story? What's your journey look like? And how did you come to do what you do today?
Well, it's been a long journey, actually, in my current role. I've been working in clinical neuropsychology for over 15 years now, since qualifying as a clinical psychologist. In that time, I've worked in a range of different services in community neurorehabilitation services within the NHS, in acute inpatient services for neurobehavioural patients and patients accessing neuropsychiatry services. And in my current post, I'm clinical lead and service lead for the neuropsychology provision in a level one neurorehabilitation service. It has taken quite a while to get to this point. And early on in my career, I started work as an assistant psychologist, having completed a bachelor's in psychology. In that role early on, I found that I was quite interested in neurorehabilitation. My early assistant experience was in neurorehab, and I was fortunate to work alongside some really good clinical psychologists to develop a community integration service for people after brain injury. Working within an MDT setting, I could really see the value and the benefit of this role. So at that point, I was looking to access clinical psychology training. So started the clinical psychology training back in 2003. And in that training, you do a range of different placements and different specialisms, developing knowledge and skills of clinical psychology practice. So on completion of that, my specialist placement was in neurorehabilitation again. And I've continued in that field, having qualified as a clinical psychologist back in 2006. I've then continued to carry out further training and education in clinical psychology, clinical neuropsychology. And it is a specialism of clinical psychology in its own right, with an additional training route after qualifying as a clinical psychologist. So I've gone through that process, which was quite lengthy as well in itself, where you carry out some case reviews and you submit a portfolio for assessment by a panel within the Division of Neuropsychology. And that's brought us to sort of roughly where I am today and getting the experience that I've had throughout my career from supervision from clinical neuropsychologists in the region, and also with the opportunity to work in a range of different services. I've been incredibly fortunate, I think, to reach the position that I'm at.
That's really interesting. And in terms of the different services that you've worked through, do you have a particular preference for the type of roles that you perform?
I've always really enjoyed neurorehabilitation. That was my very early experience, as I said, as an assistant. And that's what I've come back to. When I've been working in rehab, I've left there to work in acute neuropsychology services. And it's a very different approach to working, because obviously you're seeing people at the acute side of an injury or illness, where, you know, they're looking at assessment and sort of helping to inform either diagnosis or looking at sort of what's needed for them further down the line. I've really enjoyed that part of it, but I still come back to the rehab element, which is the beneficial element for me, because I can then work alongside people with their families and with other carers or other professionals who are involved to really try and make a difference and help recover after an injury or illness that could be, you know, quite catastrophic in some cases, and it can cause people to obviously have a range of different experiences that are difficult to manage.
I think that's quite a key phrase, isn't it? Trying to make a difference. I think that's what we all strive to do, coming from different positions and different perspectives, but ultimately with that same overall goal.
Yeah, Absolutely. And I think in neuropsychology, I've found that you can make a difference with understanding the way in which an illness or an injury has affected the brain and the central nervous system, and helping share that understanding with the person, with their families, and making sense of some of the cognitive difficulties they experience or emotional impact of an injury and or any behavioural change. You can really sort of work together to try and share that understanding so that you've got a clear idea about what maybe needs to be focused on so that you can work together on those goals or those aims and make a difference and make some progress.
Absolutely.
So I think probably a lot of people will have heard of a kind of psychologist, but they might not necessarily know about the role of a neuropsychologist and how that differs and specialises. And obviously you were talking about neurorehabilitation as well, and the difference there between the kind of acute diagnostic side and then the longer term rehabilitation side. Do you want to just explain, I think for a lot of listeners, the kind of extra stuff and how that neuro tag at the beginning makes the difference in what you do?
Yeah, the neuro element of it is really understanding the central nervous system and understanding the brain itself, the way in which an illness or injury would affect different systems or different parts of the brain, how that has a knock-on effect in terms of someone's behaviour, the way they think about things, the way they feel about things, and a whole range of other factors as well, some of the psychosocial factors. It's really using the information and the tools that we've got in neuropsychology. We've got a range of different measures and assessments that we can use to sort of look at how the brain's functioning in practice and drawing that together with the person's experience of what they've noticed, what the family have noticed, and the differences that have occurred after an illness or injury's been sustained or an illness has been diagnosed, and then really drawing all of that information together in what we'd call it a formulation. That's true of clinical psychology, you would still work with a formulation, but with neuropsychology, you're particularly looking at the impact of a condition on the central nervous system and the impact on a person's response in relation to that. And it's focusing on those areas that the intervention would generally lie on.
I suppose for us, often our clients, unfortunately, have been through very traumatic events in the accident themselves, and there might have been other family members injured or unfortunately passed away as a result of the accident. So there's often a lot of psychological issues going on top of which they've had a brain injury that's made those kind of changes to the brain itself and how they would have functioned and processed those issues previously. Mm. So is there often a bit of untangling to do as well in terms of what's happening and why?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're not looking at an individual from a particular time point, you're looking at the person and the issues that they face in the context of their life. So everything that, you know, their lived experience up until the point of injury, and then there might be psychological difficulties in the past, there might be other issues of trauma or other difficulties that have been apparent that people have coped with or managed or have got an impact after an injury as well. So you're not just looking at the brain injury itself and then the impact of that, you're looking at the person as a whole and what their experience has been throughout life, and also the psychological impact of, as you say, those other factors. You know, there's trauma, you know, if people have got, you know, a different degree of memory about an injury or an incident. In many cases, we find that patients might not remember an injury itself because of the retrograde amnesia and post-traumatic amnesia, but they might have heard information from relatives, and that can be traumatic in and of itself. And so obviously there's other consequences, and it's wide-ranging. It affects the whole family system. You know, we're never just looking specifically at the injury and then the sequelae that would arise as a result of that. We're looking at the whole family system and the person within that family system, including their lived experience to date.
It sounds like you do a lot with the family as well, for the reasons you've explained. So working kind of quite holistically with the people that are important to your patient and helping them presumably as well in how best to communicate and kind of go through those issues.
So I think much of the work can involve a lot of what we'd call indirect work as well, which is as you described, Kate, that's the type of work that you would do with family members, with anyone else who might be involved in the person's rehab and recovery, whether it's other professionals and or carers. And then there's the direct work that we would do directly with the involving the patient and the person themselves. But yeah, there is, in neuropsychology, there is a lot of the neurorehabilitation work that would involve that indirect way of working, where we look at sort of sharing information and having a good understanding, and also working to together, which is so important for the person, that everyone involved in their rehab and recovery works together so that we can hopefully get the best outcomes for them and get life, you know, sort of have the best quality of life that they can have after an injury.
So you mentioned before all the studying and all the extra time and all the extra parts there were to put in that neuro tag on the beginning. So was there anything in particular that attracted you to the neuro rehabilitation and psychology rather than just what was already a very hard academic route anyway after doing psychology, just parking up there?
I think I must like a challenge. Yes, I went into it completely with my eyes open. I knew exactly what neuropsychology involved and that there was extensive training after qualifying as a clinical psychologist. And it didn't deter me, actually. And I think that says something about the role itself and the field that I work in and how much I've enjoyed those earlier experiences in my career and how much value I think that can make. And for me, it's really important to be, you know, in a role that I enjoy, that I feel is making a difference and is valued by people. And it's valuable to myself in that sense as well. When you see someone come through the process of rehab and recovery after an injury, that it's incredibly rewarding to see how, you know, people recover and the positive impact that you can have when you're working together with them and their family and the team around them. So yeah, so I undertook it in the full knowledge of what was involved. And at times along the way I did think, you know, was this definitely the right career path for me? But it was, it absolutely was. And I have no regrets.
That's good to hear. So just picking up on something that you mentioned there, Laura, about the importance of everybody who's involved in the rehabilitation working together, that does lead to how the neuropsychologist fits in within the MDT structure as a whole. Could you just tell us a bit more about how that works in practice? What does it look like when you are asked to become part of a treating team for rehabilitation purposes?
So when you form as a rehab team, often you might be fortunate that you've worked with the professionals in the team, the other therapists that on other rehab pathways, but sometimes you might be forming a team as a group of professionals who've not worked together before. And you need to obviously have a good understanding of the other professional backgrounds and the contribution that they make to the MDT. Communication is absolutely key, I think, to MDT working and to good MDT working. I think, you know, over the course of my experience, I've got a really good understanding of what, you know, different professionals, different allied health professionals would do in the rehab process. But that's not to say that there's not more to learn and to discover. And I'm very open to hearing from other professionals as to what they think might be indicated or helpful for a person on their recovery than your rehab. I think coming together as an MDT, it's helping other people understand your role as a neuropsychologist as well. And sometimes there might be a bit of a blurring of boundaries as to what lies with neuropsychology versus occupational therapy. But we need to work collaboratively. We need to work together, essentially, so that we can get the best outcomes for the person. And sometimes that might be, we would sort of look at from the outset as a team, what we think is achievable, what's manageable, what the pathway could look like, and think about how we will work together to support the person. At the centre of that, of course, is the person themselves and the family and what they choose to work on, what they see is important. And what we would do as an MDT forming together is really sort of work with the person and their family around their goals and what they want for rehab. I think sometimes in past experiences, it can be the case that you can see potential that might be there for someone, but if that's not consistent with what their goal is, then, you know, it can lead to a bit of discord and you might not achieve that. It's so important to hold in mind what the person's goal is, where they want to get to, and also how we work together to help support and facilitate that. Having a clear outline of what we can offer, but also working really closely together, having meetings so that we can look at the progress that someone's making, where we're at in their recovery and their rehabilitation, and also just thinking about, you know, if there are any issues that come up along the way, having that communication and having that discussion so you can try and sort of tackle any problems or any difficulties or barriers to rehab early on and as soon as they present.
And of course, goals can change, can't they? It's often a very dynamic and fluid situation.
Absolutely. And the goals can change quite noticeably, or people might hold in mind what their overall goal is, and they might need support to break down that overall goal into smaller goals that help us reach that eventual outcome. But you know, we're always holding in mind where we're at the point of forming the MDT and starting our work with an individual and looking at the baseline at that point in time. So we look to where we can get to, but we need the goals that are achievable and that are also relevant along the way to map that out. And you're right, goals do change over time as true to life. Obviously, our focus can change at times and other factors in and around our lives can affect what we think is important and what's valued at that point. So yes, understandably, people's goals might change.
And I guess that means that you need to bring a very flexible and creative mindset to the MDT to be able to cope and respond appropriately to the changing dynamics.
Yeah, I think you have to be flexible and just responsive to what the individual is telling you as well. You know, this is their recovery and their experience that we're a part of at this stage. And so it's really important that we do keep that in mind and we are flexible and adapt to the changes that they sort of bring about, but also use our professional judgment and knowledge to advise them as well and give them the information that they may need to make decisions and choices.
It's a very privileged position, isn't it, for you, but for all of us, really. But I think especially in terms of the sorts of things that you do, being involved with that family and dealing with what are very private and sensitive issues and concerns sometimes, especially when we're looking at behaviours and relationships and how they might have been before the injury or illness and how they are now, and trying to ensure that they're communicating with you about, as you say, what's important to them, but being honest as well about how it is. Is there often a time where kind of what your injured or ill person might be saying is very different in comparison to what family members are saying?
Yes, that can often be the case, Kate. And as a clinical psychologist by background, whenever we start working with someone, we do so in the context of having a confidential relationship and a trusting professional relationship. So, you know, obviously within the realms of confidentiality, I would expect that the person I'm working with could share information. And unless obviously there was significant risks that could be held in confidence, what we would probably do if there's disagreement is look at how we address that and how we sort of get a shared understanding of still what's important, what do we need to do to reach a sort of an outcome. But sometimes the families have got different, obviously different experience and different views about things, and they'll perceive things differently. So we need to take on board that information and what they're telling us. It's all very relevant, isn't it, to have an understanding of what others in the family experience, because that can actually help with the rehab itself. What we find is after injury, people may lack insight and awareness, and having feedback from family members and other professionals and the care team, if there's a care team involved, can really help build awareness for patients and help them understand some of the difficulties that they're experiencing after an injury. And if they view things in a different way, as is sometimes the case, we could work on that and try and sort of broaden that understanding so that you've got a range of different perspectives. And it might not change the path you take, it might not change the focus of the work, but it's having that understanding of difference of opinion so that you can work together so that there's less of that disagreement or differing opinion.
And in terms of the MDT, Laura, how do Mark and I, how do the lawyers fit in with how you work, and I suppose what do you want from us, and how does it work best for you when that happens?
I think the thing that as a treating clinician I would need from yourselves is information about the process or information that is shared that can be disclosed, because that has an impact on the process of rehab, and often the litigation process will affect how the individual and maybe their family are responding at times. Obviously we know that it can be really stressful, but in treating and working with an MDT on the rehab pathway, I would very much see the litigation process as running alongside that, in parallel to that. So within the litigation team, we might be sharing, as a treatment team, we might be sharing information so that you're up to date with obviously where someone's at in terms of goals and what we think is needed for the future and recommendations, but it's always with the person's overarching goals in mind. Our role as a treating team and my role as a member of that treating team would be to look at the clinical picture and what's needed clinically. So I do try and separate out to some extent the litigation process and encourage the individual and their family to do the same. I think it is entwined, of course it is entwined, but the impact of that litigation process running alongside can be quite difficult to manage, and it is long term, and it takes, you know, months and years to move through that process. That can be really difficult for people to cope with over that course of time, and also difficult to feel that they're still in rehabs of months and years down the line. And what we need to look at is what's manageable from a clinical point of view, and what's reasonable and what's recommended clinically, and try and keep that focus in mind. And whether the stresses with the person and their family that come about from litigation, if, you know, dates for hearings are knocked back and that has an impact that causes stress or anxiety. And we, you know, we see that in day-to-day practice when we're working with someone, we can see the impact. So it's trying to hold in mind that they're separate processes really that are going along, but obviously there's going to be overlap and there's going to be impact for the individual. It's a challenge at times.
I think we have the same challenge as Laura to explain and differentiate the very different processes in many clients' minds, going to see medical experts and not fully understanding that the nature of that appointment is very different to meeting with the neuropsychologist within the MDT or the OT or the physiotherapist. And it causes a lot of difficulty. And as you say, the stress, the fatigue, the all of the kind of logistical challenges of pulling together what can often be a complicated rehabilitation process with a very complex piece of litigation. It sometimes surprises me that anybody gets through the process.
Yeah, and you're right, you know, it's managing those appointments and also the expectations. And if someone's feeling that they're working alongside a treating MDT, it can be difficult to understand why they also need to see independent experts, particularly if they have to see two of the same profession for the defence. And it's hard for them to, I guess, understand at times why that is all necessary. So we do have to manage expectations. We do have to manage the practical impact, as you say, the fatigue that might be associated with attending appointments that are often at a distance. The world of remote working has obviously eased that to some extent, but in resuming face-to-face appointments, you know, people sometimes have to travel quite substantially, and the fatigue that they would have a knock-on effect on the therapy for the days that follow, perhaps. And we have to manage that as a treating MDT, and also manage the longer-term expectations and view as well. I think sometimes, in my experience certainly, there have been times where the people I've been working with have seen the end of litigation as the end of rehab in general, and the end of the whole process. And I think working as a neuropsychologist, I've always been mindful that, you know, trying to separate out those processes so that people can look at the rehab as being a separate, you know, that's the thing that's going to improve independence and try and improve quality of life overall. And we're looking to get to a point in that process where they can live their lives without the rehab input. So they can live their lives without the rehab input, or certainly without the amount of rehab that they've needed, and maybe with a reduced support package or with support from family, but seeing it as a separate process so that the end of litigation isn't always the end of rehab, and vice versa, the end of rehab may be reached. We may have reached rehab potential and be reducing down what's needed before that litigation process is resolved.
Yes, agreed. You spoke before, Laura, about your role in supporting clients to reach their goals. When you reflect on your role within the MDT, what does good actually look like? To what extent are you able to determine whether or not you've succeeded in what you set out to achieve?
I think good looks like supporting the person to really look in detail at what their goals are, supporting them to identify the goals in the first place, to recognise the impact of an injury, to have a good awareness and understanding of that impact so that they are better equipped to use a lot of the strategies that professionals might recommend for them. Good involves very clear communication within the MDT and supporting the person to look at the specifics of different goals and to look at supporting them through those goals to achieve them. And then I think the outcome that we're always looking for is trying to align as much as possible a person's current daily function with the goals that they hold in mind and their aspirations post-injury, and maybe aligning that as much as possible to that pre-injury self and lifestyle that they held. And that's, you know, for me, that's the good outcome, when someone's satisfied or feel that they've achieved what they wanted to achieve and are able to live their life in the way that they want to live it with minimal input and intervention from an MDT, a care team or family. It's more consistent with what they would have done pre-injury. I think that would be the good outcome. It always involves a lot of hard work for the person, particularly for those around them, a lot of good communication as well. I think that just can't be underestimated. And as a treatment team, we need to be really clear and working together as well to help them achieve that.
The sense of satisfaction when you do must be enormous.
It is, actually. And I think over the course of my career, there's been many, many individuals who I can think back very fondly about the work that they've done and just feel really pleased for them and, you know, satisfied that as a treatment team we've been able to work together to help them reach the outcome that they wanted. Of course, you know, there are challenges along the way, but it is immensely rewarding when people, you know, you can step back at the end of that rehab process and sort of people are living their life as they want to be living it post-injury, having come through what's been a really difficult journey and having got to a point. And that's not to say at other points in the future they might not need increased input or different input. I think that's true for life, though, for everybody, isn't it? At different times in our life, we need different things. And it's just responding to that as and when needed. But yeah, it's incredibly rewarding.
Mm-hmm. And really good for lawyers like me and Kate to hear that rehabilitation can work and make a huge difference. And from our perspective in the litigation, it's not about the money, it's about what the money can actually secure. And effective rehabilitation has to be absolutely number one priority at the start, middle and the end of the case.
Yeah, it can help people to, as you say, it's not about the money, it's about what that enables the person to do. And yeah, from my perspective, if that enables somebody to live their life as they would have chosen to live it pre-injury or as close to that ideal as they can, then that's a good outcome. And obviously we want people to have the best quality of life after an injury and to be able to sort of enjoy life.
I always say we can't turn the clock back, because that would be a magical power that I would love to have for so many of these people. But what our aim to do is to put them as closely as possible back to how they would have been had the event not happened. So you spoke there, Laura, obviously about the good stuff, but you also mentioned about the challenges. Are there some kind of common challenges that crop up quite often, and what do you try and do as an individual and within your MDT to try and address those and surpass them?
I think some of the challenges that can arise can be, well, where you've got disagreement or a lack of engagement, it can be difficult to try and sort of to overcome that. As a treating team working individually, I would always be having conversations with the person and their family and those relevant to find out what, you know, if there's an issue with engagement, what's driving that, where did that come from, where do they see themselves at this point, and what can we do either differently or what can we do to help overcome it and sort of get around that issue so that it's not a barrier to their rehabilitation. As a team, just understanding where someone's at, you know, at the point of their rehab, people do find it quite difficult. It can be really challenging, difficult to be facing some of the issues of loss along the way, and often therapies are obviously highlighting that, so it's really difficult and recognising that. But I think the way we overcome it is working together, and sometimes that might be having joint sessions and joint appointments and working, you know, as a psychologist and neuropsychologist, working with other professionals to support the person's engagement during those therapies that might be challenging for whatever reason. It might just be having those, you know, looking at the experience of the person and reformulating, because things do change. We might need to sort of look at other factors that become apparent as the rehab process carries on, and we might need to reformulate and think about where someone's at. We might need to consider whether a break's needed or whether we need to sort of reduce back input for a period of time. If there's disagreement about what's manageable or what's reasonable, then it's about clear communication and having those conversations with everyone present, so there's a shared understanding of different professional perspectives. And really, I think working together to try and look at what's important for the person, where we think they can, you know, reach or where their rehabilitation potential lies, and if there's things we can do to support that for them to achieve it, then we would put strategies in place. And it might be that's, you know, it's, as you said earlier, Mark, it's got to be really flexible and you've got to be responsive to what's happening at a point in time of a person's journey and look at that. You know, we might have expectations that someone can achieve, you know, certain outcomes, but their engagement within that is so key, and without that, you can't achieve that. So you need to work with the barriers or work with the issues that come up as they come up and be responsive to it.
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting from my kind of non-clinical perspective, seeing clients. I can remember one who just didn't have that insight and didn't want to engage, didn't see a need for kind of open quote therapy. But the MDT worked really well and kind of learned about them and that they really liked cooking, and it was something that they hadn't been able to do since. So with a combination, as you say, of the MDT joining up with the OT, the neuropsychology and physio, worked on planning a meal, what ingredients were needed, going to the shop, writing the lists, what tasks were needed, and then standing in the kitchen, engaging the core, kind of working on limb weakness, and then cooking that meal. And the MDT or the clinicians were able to see that that was absolutely tremendous as rehabilitation and goal setting and everything that was going into that task. But for the client involved, they were just cooking a meal. It was just what they did before the accident and something that they actually wanted to do since. And so I think that responsiveness, as you say, and that adaptability is just fantastic to be able to see in practice for clients.
Yeah, and it has to be meaningful for people, for clients. The rehab has to be meaningful. You know, it's got to be about what they value, what they want. And that, as much as, you know, we look to see what the person's lifestyle was like pre-injury and obviously sort of consider lifestyle factors before the injury, we also accept and understand that what's meaningful and valuable in a person's life can change, obviously on the back of quite a significant injury. And so they might want different things out of life at that point as well. So we're not always looking to offer rehabilitation with the overall goal of returning to work. If someone worked before the injury, that might have changed entirely. So we do need to look at what's meaningful for the person and also what they'll find valuable as well.
Just returning to the interrelationship, Laura, between the litigation and the rehabilitation process, and we touched on this briefly about some of the challenges that throws up. Do you see any tension between the two, the litigation process and the rehabilitation process?
Maybe I've been fortunate, Mark. You might have experienced more tension than I have. In the rehab packages that I've worked on, I've not experienced a great deal of tension between the litigation process and the MDT. I think it's always worked really well, and maybe I've been fortunate with my experiences to date, but I think it probably has worked well, and there maybe haven't been so many tensions because we've had, as an MDT and as an individual within that MDT, had a clear understanding of what the litigation team need from the treating team. And also we've had good communication with the litigation team about the stage that the case is at and the factors that might come up that might be a little bit destabilizing for the person or for the family. And we've worked together to think about how to manage those, to minimize the impact of any difficulties with the litigation process. We've always thought about the impact on the person and the family in having that information communicated. And maybe really fortunate that there hasn't been a lot of tensions. I wouldn't be looking for them, but I think we've just been fortunate having good working relationships with litigation and also the treating teams, and good communication as well.
It sounds like working with good lawyers, which is the key.
I think that must be the key, absolutely.
So, Laura, then, what is your proudest achievement to date? It's a tricky one, hearing the length and breadth of your career, but I don't know if there's any that spring to mind.
There's not one proudest achievement, I think, that spring to mind. I think many achievements along the way, and gosh, I hope that doesn't sound the way it sounds in my head, but I think I'm really proud of the work that I've done with people, individuals and their families. I'm very proud of where I'm at now in terms of my career and having the privilege to work with a lot of excellent neuropsychologists in offering a range of different services, both in NHS work and in also private practice. And I think along the way, some of the key highlights would be establishing a neurobehavioural service for patients who were discharged from the inpatient neurobehavioural rehab service, particularly because when there's a behavioural presentation after an injury, there's a range of complexity there that can be really difficult. And I think the proudest achievements I have are supporting those individuals who had revolved, who had been discharged from inpatient services to, whether it was back to their own family home, whether it was to a residential placement, but that had then broken down, which had resulted in them being readmitted to an inpatient neurobehavioural service. And I'm really proud of being able to support those individuals and work with everyone involved to enable them to move back to either home or placement and be supported in the way that they need to be supported. And that's through a lot of work around education and training, but also supervision and providing the right type of intervention to meet someone's needs. So I think, yeah, that definitely stands out as one of the highlights of my career. And I think it's about, maybe I like a challenge, I guess, thinking about the neuropsychology and thinking about the complexity in neurobehavioral rehab, but they are the areas that I think, yeah, I'm really proud of the individuals I've worked with, of what they've been able to achieve, and being supported in the right way is so important.
And I think probably what our listeners can't see but can hopefully hear is when you're talking about it, you're talking with such passion and there's such a beam of a smile on your face as well when you're recounting quite rightly the things that you've managed to achieve in your career and that you're continuing to do, and that's just fantastic to see as well.
It's just a privilege, isn't it, to be invited into somebody's life at the point of time where things are incredibly difficult because of the injury that's been sustained. And it's not just with the individual who's had the injury, it's with the family as well. And life's turned upside down. And it's a privilege to be invited in at that time to support and work with people in the most difficult of circumstances. If I can make a difference, if I can make that more manageable and work together to help that process and to help people achieve the goals that they have, then I think that's a good outcome. And I am, yeah, incredibly passionate about what clinical neuropsychology can offer in a rehab process, and also feel very privileged to be able to work alongside some excellent professionals and some really outstanding individuals actually to help them achieve what they want in life.
Laura, you spoke before about making a difference, and you absolutely do.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I hope so.
Thank you so much for joining us today. That's been absolutely fascinating, really interesting, and just better understanding from my part and Kate's part about the role of the neuropsychologist in the MDT. So thank you again.
Thanks very much to all of you. Very much enjoyed listening to that. Very quickly for me, we release our webinars, podcasts and blogs on a regular basis, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And obviously that includes all episodes of this podcast series. You can also follow the Neurotrauma team on Twitter, two accounts, at Sintons Neuro and also at Sintons PI. If you'd like to discuss anything our speakers have raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with them. Their contact details can be found on their respective websites and also via their LinkedIn profiles. We hope you've enjoyed listening to them as much as we have enjoyed recording them, and that they've been beneficial and added value to you. Thank you once again for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you.